Welcome to Asia Calling, your window on Asia. Coming up on the show this week, spying allegations in Pakistan and a hotly debated death sentence that's causing regional tensions. And we hear from Rohingya, the Muslim minority group that has been driven out of Myanmar in the hundreds of thousands. We trace the story of two Rohingya people who have watched firsthand as waves of violence have unravelled around them throughout their lives. And for Rohingya who have fled to India, seeking refuge isn't always as safe as it seems. And at the end of the program, we deep dive into the extreme world of beauty pageants in the Philippines. Thanks for tuning into the show. I'm Nicole Kirby. Pressure is again mounting between South Asia's nuclear-armed rivals, Pakistan and India, after Pakistan last week sentenced an Indian citizen to death on charges of espionage and terrorism. India strongly denies the allegations and warns that going ahead with the execution would further deteriorate an already very tense relationship. From Karachi, Pakistan, Naeem Sahutra has this report.
I am Commander Kulbhushan Jadhav, number 4155 Zulu. I am a serving officer of the Indian Navy.
In this video statement, Indian Naval Officer Kulbhushan Jadhav makes the incredible confession that he acted as an Indian spy in Pakistan.
And my cover name was Hussain Mubarak Patel.
The video has been used as evidence in a military trial that last week convicted Jadhav of espionage and sabotage activities and sentenced him to death.
I have been directing various activities in Balochistan and Karachi at the behest of law.
And in it, Jadhav admits to supporting the insurgency of Baloch nationalists in southwest of Pakistan and to involvement in terrorism at the commercial hub of Karachi. Activities, he says, that were instigated by India's spy agency, Research and Analysis Wing, or ROW.
My purpose was to hold meetings with Baloch insurgents and carry out activities with their collaboration. These activities have been of criminal nature. These have been of anti-national, anti-terrorist, leading into the killing of or maiming of Pakistani citizens also.
Jadhav allegedly established a small shop in neighboring Iran in 2003.
And established a small business in Chabar in Iran.
From there, he directed undercover operatives in Pakistan who worked for the Indian spy agency ROW. Pakistan has long accused Indian spy agency ROW of funding a violent insurgency in the minerals-rich province of Balochistan.
This is nothing less than a state-sponsored terrorism. They are very few examples in the world where a senior serving officer is involved in such activities and is caught.
That's Lieutenant General Asim Bajwa, then spokesperson for Pakistan's armed forces, announcing Jadhav's arrest. He claimed that Jadhav was plotting to destabilize a $46 billion economic corridor in Balochistan, project that would give Pakistan's economy an edge over India.
Their plan was to disrupt the China-Pakistan economic corridor. They plan to target Gwadar port in Balochistan and infiltrate with 30 to 40 ROW agents entering from the Pakistan coast near Gwadar. Their task was also to revive the nationalist insurgency, which has been dying down in Balochistan.
But India forcefully denies the allegations, claiming Jadhav was framed under false charges. They argue the video confession has been edited and that its authenticity is doubtful. Sushma Swaraj, Indian Minister for External Affairs, told the parliament that Pakistani agencies kidnapped Jadhav while he was doing business in Iran and that he did not receive a fair trial.
I rise to share my concern with the House regarding the report that an Indian citizen, Shri Kulbhushan Jadhav, has been awarded a death sentence by a Pakistan military court-martial on concocted charges. I repeat, on concocted charges.
The neighboring countries have long accused each other of spying. In India, 53 Pakistanis are currently under arrest for spying, while Islamabad has also arrested dozens of Indians for the same crime. The Human Rights Commission of Pakistan says many suspected spies have been tortured to death in prisons on both sides. But India has never executed a suspected spy, and Pakistan has only executed one. In New Delhi, Swaraj warned of grave consequences if Pakistan goes ahead with the execution.
Under these circumstances, we have no choice but to regard this sentence, if carried out, as an act of premeditated murder. Let me state clearly that the government and people of India would view very seriously the possibility that an innocent Indian citizen is facing death sentence in Pakistan without due process and in violation of basic norms of law, justice and international relations. I would caution the Pakistan government to consider the consequences for our bilateral relationship if they proceed on this matter.
Kulbhushan Jadhav's conviction comes at a crucial moment as India and Pakistan plan to resume long-awaited dialogue on key issues, including the dispute over Kashmir and controversial dam projects. But for now, Jadhav's death sentence has further stalled any prospects of the nuclear-armed rivals resolving their deep tensions. For Asia Calling, this is Naeem Sohotra in Karachi, Pakistan.
Staying with India, its relationship with another neighbour is causing strain within the country. Thousands of Myanmar's Muslim minority group Rohingya have fled persecution and now live in exile around the world, including in India. But as Bismillah Gilani reports from New Delhi, Hindu nationalist groups have launched a campaign to drive Rohingya out of the country, and the push is gaining traction.
70-year-old Muhammad Yaqub was among the first Rohingya to flee violence in his home country Myanmar and take refuge in India. He has been living in a Delhi refugee camp since 2012. Life here is tough, but he has no regrets about coming to India.
It was genocide going on there, so we just left everything behind and came here with our families to save our lives and our faith. We have no facilities here. The government doesn't help us, and the United Nations Refugee Agency has only given us a cart and nothing else. But we are safe here.
Late last year, entire villages in the western state of Rakhine were destroyed by fire, allegedly at the hands of the military. About 40,000 Rohingya are currently seeking refuge in India, but they are all now afraid they will be forced to return to Myanmar, where they face ongoing violence. Earlier this month, officials in India's Ministry of External Affairs revealed that the government is working on a plan to track down Rohingya and deport them. The move follows intensified protests from Hindu nationalist groups who claim Rohingya are a threat to India's national security and should be expelled. Ravinder Jain is a member of the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party or BJP, which currently holds government.
There has been a rise in incident of theft, hooliganism and kidnapping because of these refugees. You can control law and order problem, but these people are a threat to the nation. Our national security is at risk because of them. Such people should not be given shelter under any circumstances. They should be immediately thrown out.
The Rohingya community and human rights advocates are deeply worried by the government's stance. Raghu Menon from Amnesty International India says it runs counter to India's long-running practice of protecting refugees.
this came as a shock for us, because apart from it being a violation of India's commitment under international human rights law and refugee law, it would also go against the grain of humanitarian philosophy and policy that India has always applied to people fleeing persecution.
In 2012, after riots and deadly clashes between Myanmar's Buddhist majority and Muslim minority, thousands of Rohingya fled to India. The government, then led by Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, allowed them to stay in India, despite opposition from Hindu nationalist groups. But since Narendra Modi's BJP party came to power in 2014, the clamor to send them back has grown louder. Last week, the Chamber of Trade and Commerce in the northern city of Jammu threatened to kill Rohingya refugees if the government doesn't deport them. Rakesh Gupta is vice president of the group.
If their own country does not accept them, why should we? This is our last warning to the government. If they do not act and deport them within a month, we are going to launch an identify and kill campaign against them. We believe we are perfectly justified to deal with them in any manner.
Some political parties and civil society organizations have come out in support of Rohingya, urging the government to immediately roll back the deportation plan. Himmat Singh, president of the United Peace Movement, says Rohingyas are being singled out because of their religion.
If Rohingya cannot live here, how can we justify giving shelter to other refugees? There are so many here. We even have an exiled government here, and we invited the Dalai Lama and his people. Why are only Muslims being targeted?
Despite being home to thousands of refugees, India is not a signatory to the United Nations Refugee Convention or the protocol relating to the status of refugees. The country doesn't have any laws to protect the rights of refugees. Raghu Menon from Amnesty International India says this leaves refugees in India in a very vulnerable position.
Because of the lack of law, what has happened is that asylum and refugee in India is granted, on the whims and fancies of the people in power. So today you might be welcome, tomorrow suddenly you are not welcome. And that cannot happen. Granting refugee status, granting access, protecting people who are fleeing persecution is a humanitarian cause and need that every government, every responsible government should adhere to.
From New Delhi, this is Bismillah Gilani for Asia Calling.
You're listening to Asia Calling KBR. Until a refugee crisis in recent years, many of us had barely heard of Myanmar's Muslim minority, Rohingya. But from inside Myanmar, the group has faced persecution for six decades. Even now, despite the promises of Nobel laureate and de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi to resolve internal conflicts, the violence rages on. In October last year, Myanmar security forces allegedly killed as many as 600 Rohingya and forced an estimated 40,000 to leave their homes in Rakhine State. It's just the latest chapter in a much longer story. In this report, Kanika Pechkau traces the Rohingya story from citizenship to stateless refugees over a lifetime.
I am Ubase. I was born in Budidong Township of Arkana State, Western Burma in 1952.
I am Dokhenla, a Rohingya woman. I was born in Budidong Township of Arkan State in 1953.
For Ubaseng and Dokhenla, Myanmar is home. Their families have lived in the northern Myanmar state of Rakhine, or Arakan, as it was historically known for generations. They have given birth there, fled, worked, married, and died there.
My father was a civil servant and I myself worked for the Ministry of Cooperative in my hometown until 1991.
But the Myanmar government considers them illegal immigrants. Ubaseng and Dokila are Rohingya, a Muslim minority in the majority Buddhist nation of Myanmar.
My parents were born in Arkan and were buried in the Arkan soil. My grandparents were born there. They live and work in all their lives, both under the British colonial rule and after Burma's independence in 1948.
Many Rohingya arrived in Myanmar, or Burma as it was then known, from neighboring Bangladesh and India under British colonial rule. But the group's connection to the area stretches back centuries. Since independence in 1948, the Muslim minority has faced ongoing conflict in Myanmar. In 1949, Dokila's grandfather feared for their future in the new nation, so he wrote to the Myanmar Minister of Justice asking to confirm their citizenship. He says they were assured their citizenship was safe. But it's a promise that was not honored. When she was just a child, Dokila remembers seeing her family's proud legacy destroyed.
Even my father, who was a police officer, the authority didn't spare even his properties. I couldn't control my tears by seeing the tension of my father, even I was too young.
And that was just the beginning. Ubaseng remembers watching new waves of violence crash over the families throughout his lifetime. When he was 26, a large military operation was launched against Rohingya insurgents who were fighting against the government. But many believe all Rohingya became targets.
I am not only Rohingya eyewitness who lived through the King Dragon operation in 1978. There were many people in different towns and villages of also witnessed in torture, arrest and inhumanity during the large-scale operation against Rohingya.
250,000 Rohingya fled to Bangladesh at the time. Soon after, in 1982, Rohingya were stripped of Burmese citizenship. More than 800,000 Rohingya in Northern Rakhine became stateless.
I saw with my own eyes teams of Burmese and Rakhine local authorities confiscating official ID cards from those who had them and arresting and taking away anyone with their handcuffs, including young children who were not yet eligible for ID card.
By 1992, Dokila and Ubaseng had their own families and were living in Rakhine when Rohingya were struck by another wave of violence. Restriction of movement, education, and marriage were imposed. Dokila remembers seeing people living in despair.
I was pregnant at that time, and I saw from my window how the people were fleeing at night and how their properties, houses were burned down. I saw all these things with my own eyes.
It was the final blow for Dokila.
Since then, I started thinking to leave the country. As I could imagine, the situation for Muslims will become the most worsened.
Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya again fled. It was the starting of the decade-long exodus that left Rohingya scattered across the globe. Dokila and Ubaseng are among them. They now live in the United Kingdom as stateless refugees.
In 2002, all of my family members reunited in one country, but unfortunately later, after 3 years, we had to separate again. Now we are in three different countries.
But hundreds of thousands of other Rohingya are living in camps in Bangladesh and Rakhine, where conditions are dire. Earlier this year, a United Nations Human Rights Investigation Team found almost half of those living in refugee camps in Bangladesh reported they have a family member killed or missing. Over half of the women interviewed had experienced rape or other forms of sexual violence. A peace conference between the Myanmar government and minority groups is scheduled for May. with the aim of ending the six-decade-long civil war. But many believe that prospects for the peace process are bleak, with dim hopes that this long story of violence can be brought to an end. In the meantime, families like Dokila's remain stateless and separated. For Asia Calling, this is Kanika Petkau from Myanmar.
And finally, from small villages to the bigger cities, beauty pageants are huge across the Philippines. Filipinos know the names of beauty queens like Brazilians know their football heroes. Jofel Tesorio and Ariel Carlos from Manila and Palawan report on the country's obsession with beauty.
It's the middle of a grueling practice for girls who are competing in a local beauty pageant. They sashay back and forth in high heels to perfect their walk without tripping. Their trainer, Tom Fabula, explains the rigors of his beauty boot camp.
During training, when the girls wake up, we start the day with jogging. After jogging, we have breakfast, followed by walking exercises. After that, we teach them how to put on makeup, and that is followed by question and answer exercises.
Most of his students come from impoverished backgrounds. One of them is 20-year-old Janice Lubina, who represented the Philippines in the Miss International pageant in Japan last December.
Representing my country here in Miss International is a great honor and achievement for me.
Janice was close to win the Miss Philippines Universe title, where the winner, Filipina Pia Wurtzbach, became Miss Universe last year. In 2013, Janice was the runner-up in the Miss World Philippines. She is often called the Filipino Cinderella.
When I was in third year, my mother and dad told me, "I'm not a farmer."
When I was in third year high school, my father had a stroke. I went farming and worked as a housemaid because my mother was also a housemaid. I'm proud of where I came from. I think I've inspired a lot of girls who also came from a poor background.
Janice was spotted when she was 16 by a local talent scout in a farming village in Palawan. Joining the beauty contest world, says Janice, was her way of escaping poverty and helping her family.
It helps a lot. I've started to have a house built for my family. My priority also is to establish our education. I'm sending my two brothers to school.
The Philippines is a nation crazy for beauty pageants. It started in 1969 when 19-year-old Gloria Diaz became the first Filipina Miss Universe. The Philippines has won 3 Miss Universe titles, 4 Miss International, 1 Miss World, 2 Miss Earth, and dozens of smaller international beauty contests.
Miss Universe 2015 is Philippines.
The Filipinos' love for beauty pageants intensified after Pia Wurtzbach was crowned Miss Universe after 42 years. During Pia's homecoming in Manila, traffic was completely halted and life momentarily stopped. Psychology professor Vincent Quevada explains why Filipinos are addicted to beauty pageants.
I think the reason why we love beauty pageants is that Filipino is rooting for someone like to epitomize their wants to become somebody someday. For example, a typical Filipino would desire that. Most likely it's because of the poverty here. Filipino would love to see a story of a Cinderella-like story. You know, Filipinos, maybe a part of it is we desire to become someone or somebody someday.
But the path to beauty queen was not easy for Janice Lubina. It took her more than 3 years in beauty bootcamp and several attempts in beauty contests. She spent months of rigorous training, 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, including makeup and catwalk training, and what they call personality development. Some girls fainted during the first day of training, she says, and others quit after a few days.
Kumbaga, as hawang tayo ay tumatanda, yung happiness natin mas...
Here at this local beauty pageant for Miss Puerto Princesa City in Palawan, candidates are being introduced. One of them, 24-year-old Shera Delizay, looks up to Janice. But unlike Janice, Shera is from the middle class, a college graduate and an English teacher.
Janice Lubina is a very, very strong person because despite all the negative comments that were thrown to her of the public, because she's very poor and she admits that, and most of the people actually during her pageantry, they were very much doubtful about her qualities and capabilities. But Chanisel is very strong to face all these negative comments, and she turned them down, the negative comments, and made it a challenge to herself to improve on it.
Another candidate, 24-year-old Mia Bianca Dantes, thinks she has a chance at the crown. A registered nurse, Bianca is studying for a master's degree.
I really wanted to join first to pursue my dreams, to boost my confidence in myself, and of course to empower, educate, and inspire the new generations of today, to help them show their talents and what they can do, whoever they are and whoever whatever they do.
Models do that, but queens don't do that.
Back at the boot camp, talent scout Tom Pavila says he's grooming another candidate who could win him the Miss Universe title. She is a dusky young woman from a remote island who stands almost 6 feet tall. After all, Tom says, Filipinos like beautiful underdogs. With Ariel Carlos from Manila and Palawan, Philippines, this is Jofel Tesorio for Asia Calling.
That's all for this edition of Asia Calling. Our program today was produced in the studios of KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. To find out more about our show, send us a message on our Asia Calling Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Asia Calling for more updates. You can now also podcast the show. Go to the iTunes Store or your podcasting app and search for Asia Calling and subscribe for free to the weekly episodes. I'm Nicole Kirby, back next week with more stories from Asia.
Lama tak ku pandang, hati telah bimbang.